Verse 14, this is kind of extra, so just to let you know, sometimes we get freaked out when the Bible talks about how we're supposed to greet one another with a kiss of love, and we're thinking, ooh, that doesn't make much sense to us, because in our culture, we don't typically go up to people and kiss them. Maybe you do with your spouse, hopefully you only do it with your spouse or your kids, but typically you don't do that. But in the culture of the day, that was a way of greeting those that you cared about and those that you were their closest friends. And so whenever you see Paul, Paul does the same thing, you know, greet each other with a kiss. Peter here, greet one another with a kiss of love. It was that understanding in that culture that you are, as you gather as the church, you are to have this understanding that you're the family of God. You have brothers and sisters. Sometimes, depending on our culture, we even say that, oh, brother Isaac, or brother so-and-so, or brother or sister so-and-so. That's the kind of that understanding, this family of God. And so we would, if Peter was writing nowadays, he wouldn't probably say, no, greet one another with the kiss of love, unless you're like in South America. They do still do that. They still do kind of go up alongside people's cheeks, and they make that kissing noise sound. Again, that's kind of weird for us, but we would probably say more, you know, greet each other with a handshake, greet each other with a hug type deal. So just so that you know some of the context there. But one of the things that is so often, again, another thing that is kind of weird in our context because we don't have this, is this understanding of throne rooms. And when you look at, but when you look at this throne room, and you see that there is an actual throne room, and if I have a picture, Kenny, can you just go to the next picture there? Here we go. There is an actual throne room. This is a throne room that is in Hawaii. Some people may not realize this, but Hawaii at one point in time had its own queen, and this was the throne room. And the reason why it was important to have the throne room was because the queen or the king didn't really hang out in the throne room all the time. But it was for those special times when, like, other dignitaries would come and visit them, that they would have the throne, and the king and the queen would sit upon their throne, and they'd be all decked out in the royal garb. And there's a way you would approach the throne. If you want to know a funny scene in the John Adams series, miniseries years ago, they produced this, and we were actually living in Quincy, Massachusetts at the time, which was where John Adams is from, which was a huge ordeal because they were like, hey, they finally made a movie about John Adams. And is there a scene in that movie where as he goes and as he is about to approach the throne of the King of England, before he enters, there's this protocol of, hey, this is how you need to do it. And so there's, you got to walk a little ways, and then you curtsy. And then you walk a little further, and then you curtsy. One of the things that they portray very very well there is that John Adams did not like formalities. And then the United States had just won the war fighting against England, and now he has to go and bow before the King of England because that was the protocol. In fact, all throughout history, that was the understanding, is that there is this king. And again, you see it even in the throne room, is that the thrones are higher than everybody else in the entire room. And part of that was because the king or the queen was always had to be the tallest person. They had to be the person that stuck above the crowd. And you would never thought about looking directly into the face of the king or the queen. You'd always hide your face. Or in this picture, as you approach the king, you would bow, literally bow on your hands and knees until the king said, you can get up. And that was a sign of showing humility. That was the whole reason why they would do this, is because the sign of showing to the king, you are greater than I am. I am humble before you. I am in submission to you. I do whatever you say. Even if I disagree with you, guess what? You are king, and I do whatever you say. And again, as Americans, we don't have a king. Sometimes our presidents think that they are kings. Well, we do not have a king. And yes, we are to treat our president and our elected officials with the honor and with the dignity that they deserve. But again, one of the interesting scenes that happens at the end of that movie is when John Adams goes, and after he goes back and he's no longer president, he gets into a vehicle. That'll be a horse-drawn carriage that had many people staying. It was almost like a bus with a horse-drawn kind of bus. He gets into the cart, gets in, sits in the back, and everybody, the whole scene, everybody turns and looks at him because he's the president of the United States. And he yells out, he says, "Listen, I am Farmer Adams. Treat me like a farmer." And then he goes off to back to Massachusetts. Again, that really is the understanding of in America. But when we start talking about kings and we start talking about the role, whatever the king said, regardless of if you agreed with him or not, his word was law. And you would show that through bowing and through other ways and ultimately by obedience. And one of the things, again, we always have to keep in mind is this phrase, and we've seen this over and over again, and this is important, this phrase is important even when we talk about anywhere in the Bible, is this understanding of context. If you want to understand the context of what Peter is saying here in chapter 5, you kind of have to understand what he said before. And one of the things, and not even just literally context, but the historical context, we saw and you'll see that especially more played out next week, is this understanding of why Peter is writing this letter gives us this understanding of why Peter says what he says and why he chooses the words he chooses and what he's going about because of what is going on there in the believers there in these provinces and the persecution that they're facing. And here, the context that we want to start off with is verses 6 and 7. Again, we saw this a couple weeks ago. Last week, of course, I wasn't here because of being sick, and I'm grateful for Matt and for JR for filling in last minute with that. But verses 6 and 7, and we know these verses. We may have these verses memorized. You know, "Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you." Eventually, verse 7, I don't know about you, but I've memorized verse 7 when I was a child. You know, casting all your cares or anxiety or your worries on him because he cares for you. But when you actually look in a little more literal translation than this, the NIV, it's actually one long sentence, verses 6 and 7. It says, "Be humble, therefore, under God's mighty hand." And we talked about God's mighty hand referring to that strong arm, again, of the kings, the powerful arm, that deliverance, so that he may lift you up in time. And then it goes on, "having casted upon him all your anxiety because he is concerned about you." Again, every believer needs to humble themselves before God. This is what we saw a couple weeks ago. Every believer, every single person that believes in Jesus Christ, that it says, "I'm a follower of Jesus Christ." Every single person, every single believer needs to humble themselves before God. And the understanding of humility is realizing you are not, the world does not evolve around you. That God is king of your life, and that humility. Every believer needs to humble themselves before God. And one way we do this, according to verse 7, one way we show God that we are humility, or that we are humble to him, or that we are that he is king of our lives, is by casting our cares or our burdens or our worries upon him. Because sometimes we have maybe a wrong view of what prayer is. Sometimes we treat God like a genie in the bottle, or we treat God like Santa Claus. And we come to God and we have this long list of a prayer requests, and we go to God through prayer and say, "Okay, God, here's what I want you to do for me. Here's what I want you to do for this person that I care about. This is what I want you to do for this person or that person." And if that's all that we do in prayer, then that's the wrong attitude of prayer. Because when we go to prayer, we're not supposed to have our list of, "Okay, God, this is what I want you to do for me." Prayer is so much more than that. In fact, it's through prayer that we actually are admitting that we need God. It is through prayer, when we go to prayer, that we are actually humbling ourselves and getting on our knees. And that's why sometimes, I mean, we used to do this. We would pray at an altar. We would pray next to a table. We would pray on our knees. And again, why do we do that? It'd be that posture of saying, God, I am humbling myself before you. And I am submitting my life to your will. Which is why so many times the way we pray is actually arrogant to God. And say, God, I want you to do this in that person's life. Or, God, I want you to heal this person. And then God doesn't do it, and then we're thinking, man, God must not have heard my prayer. Well, maybe it's because our attitude stinks. And instead of saying, God, I want you to do this, instead of saying, God, here's a need. Would you work in this need in a way that is pleasing and honoring to you? Would you use this situation in this person's life to draw them to yourself? Lord, here's a need in my life. Would you work in that way for your honor and for your glory? Would you allow your will to be done in that situation? Because I'm humbled and I'm admitting to God, God, I need you in this situation. There's a song that we used to sing, and I believe you sang it last week, if I remember right from the live stream, was Sweet Hour of Prayer. And Sweet Hour of Prayer. And then there's a phrase in that song that says, you know, that there is, and I know I'm going to slaughter it, but the gist of it is that the reason why we don't have peace in our lives is because we neglect that sweet hour of prayer, that humility. That total reliance upon God. Again, prayer is more than just coming to God and rubbing the lamp or having the genie pop out or going to Santa Claus and saying, God, this is what I want you to do for me. It is that conversation, is that posture of humility and saying, God, I'm casting my cares, my burdens, my worries upon you. I'm so grateful for the fact that you take interest in me. Would you work in these situations according to your will? And then Peter goes on, and that's kind of the context for what the passage that we're looking at today. He goes on in verse 8, and then he gives us some commands of be alert and of sober minded or sober mind. And the first one, actually, again, our NIV translations, English translations, will flip-flop these, but the first one actually in the Greek is sober-minded, which means being self-controlled. Believers are to be self-controlled. That means being free from every form of drunkenness. And that this word is used more symbolically. It doesn't mean of being more controlled, every form of drunkenness in sense of being drunk with wine or alcohol. But it's this understanding of being free from every thing that controls our minds. In fact, this word is used 6 times in the New Testament, and Peter uses it half the times. We saw this word back in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 7, and then this section in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Now, we are to be self-controlled. We are not to allow anything to control us, and again, that's what addiction is. If you think of being in drunkenness, means that you have given up the control of your body, or control of your mind, to allow the alcohol or to allow whatever to control you. And it can be anything. We use drunkenness in the sense of alcohol, but it could also be being controlled by food or being controlled by coffee or being controlled by anything that way. Where it get to the point where it controls you, where you got to get it. Again, maybe some things aren't like coffee is like, man, does it really control you? Well, how many times if you don't get your coffee in the morning, are you kind of a grout where you have a major headache or whatever? It controls you. And what Peter is saying here is we need to be sober-minded. We need to be self-controlled. We need to be, the second one, we need to be on alert. We need to be alert. We need to pay attention. We are not to fall asleep. That's what this word means. And again, when I think of this word, being alert, I think of like a military person who is on guard. And I would not do well if I was a military person on guard at 1 o'clock in the morning. The enemy just come right in because I'd be sleeping. I tried past midnight, I'm no good anymore. But that's the understanding of this word. And Peter uses these and commands to believers that we are to be self-controlled. We are to be alert. We're supposed to pay attention. Well, why? Why does Peter tell the believers that we are to be in this constant readiness, this paying attention, to not let our guard down? Because he goes on in verse in the eighth verse, because he says, your enemy. Do you realize that today? You have an enemy. As a believer in Jesus Christ, you have an enemy that seeks to destroy you. And in the culture of when Peter is writing this, he's trying to explain to the disciples there in these provinces that yes, you're being persecuted. Yes, you feel like you're under attack, but understand this. Your enemy, this enemy is not the people that are persecuting you. It's not the Roman Empire. It's not your family. It's not your friends. It's not your coworkers that are persecuting you. The enemy is not that. Instead, your enemy is the devil. And he's dangerous. And he seeks to destroy you. In fact, Peter goes on and says, your enemy, the devil. And then this image here, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Now, I don't know about you, but I do not want to meet an animal, especially the lion, in real life. There's something about just seeing in zoos. I don't know, maybe I just have a healthy fear of you know, the lions and things. There's something about seeing, I've seen black bears running through the woods, more running across the street in front of us. I've seen that before, and I haven't freaked out. But there's something about a lion that when you see it in the zoo, you're thinking, I hope and pray that I never meet them down a dark alley. And then have you ever heard a lion roar before? And I know I've told this story before. We were at the Pittsburgh Zoo, and we were standing in front of the lion display, and the lion lets out a roar. And I don't know if it was a loud one or a quiet one, but either way, it sends chills down your back. Well, you can hear the lion roar. If you're in Africa, you can hear a lion's roar miles away. That's how loud it is. And Peter is trying to explain to the believers here that, listen, you have an enemy. And the enemy is not the people around you. It's not flesh and blood. Your enemy is the devil. And he desires, and he's prowling around like a roaring lion, and he desires to destroy your life. So many times, you know, when we talk about the devil, we talk about Satan, usually, at least in, because of, again, our culture, we have this image that you have the devil on one side of someone's shoulders and an angel on the other side. And the devil is usually in red and this pitchforky person. That is not, Peter says, that is not the image of that you should have of Satan, the devil. He seeks to destroy you, to wipe you out, to knock you off, to take you out, which is why He goes on in verse 9 and says, this is how you are to respond to your enemy. You are to resist him. Verse 9, resist him, standing firm in the faith. Because you know that the family of believers throughout the world is undergoing the same kind of sufferings. Again, when we think about our enemy, which is not, again, it's not the people around us. It is ultimately Satan. He is the only enemy that we have as believers in Jesus Christ. It is Satan, the devil. We have an enemy that seeks to destroy us. Okay, how do we stand? How do we not allow Satan to destroy us as believers in Jesus Christ? Peter says to resist him. Okay, how do we do that? How are we to resist, to not give in, to not allow Satan to knock us out, to destroy us, to devour us? How are we to resist the devil? By being strong in the faith. We resist the devil by being strong in the faith. Again, there are so many books out there. I've read them, not all of them, but I've read a lot of them that deal with, you know, how are we, what are some ways that we can fight against the devil? But as the more I study scripture, the more I realize that even Paul, when he talks about the armor of God and that whole scene there about how we are to put on the armor of God, has nothing to do to the fact that we are supposed to lead the charge and go out and fight Satan. And as modern day songs say, take back the ground that Satan has taken. It has everything to do with standing firm, to not be caught off guard, to not buy into the lies or the schemes of Satan, but to be able to stand firm in our faith and our trust in Jesus Christ. This understanding of being strong or being solid in the faith is like this, a cinder block. Now, if you have seen martial arts people, they can break cinder blocks. The average person, cannot. I've tried, and it hurts really bad. But the understanding of having this solid faith is this understanding of having this firm foundation, this solid foundation. Whenever you buy a house, no matter what the house looks like on the inside, if that foundation is not solid, the house will not be solid. Marguerite and I have learned that personally. We bought our house when we moved here, and we knew we had issues. We knew that there was some things that we wanted to work on. The floors weren't entirely level. And part of that was because we have a span on one side of the house where they put up one beam and there's no supports. And it was somewhere around like 13, 14 foot span with no supports in there. So we thought, well, surely we'll just bring in a contractor, put in a beam in the middle there and support that. And maybe they can jack it up a little bit so that we don't have the one side of our house going like this. So first month we moved there, we call in a contractor. He says, you have bigger issues than your floor is sloping. You have a cracked footer. And this one wall of your foundation is cracked. Needless to say, that was not what we wanted to hear. And again, that solid foundation is important. So we have spent the last 3 years fixing our foundation and getting it to the place where it is, there's no more cracks, where it's solid, where it's not going to move anymore. This is not a picture of our house, but if you have a house on a solid foundation that will not move, then it'll last the test of time. But what happens if you have a house built on a bad foundation? And these are real pictures. This is an apartment building with a bad foundation that's about ready to collapse. Or here's a house. Now, needless to say, this was in a storm, one of the hurricanes. But either way, the first floor is almost completely underground because the foundation gave away in that storm. So how do we resist the devil? How do we stand firm? We have this enemy that is seeking to destroy us, that is seeking to knock us out. How, as our lives, how do we stand firm to the place where our foundation is solid so that our lives don't crumble and Satan destroys us? Well, God gives us the answer in verses 10 through 11 of how God works in our lives. And as God works in our lives in these ways, He works in us in a way that we become this solid, have this solid foundation in our lives where we are able to stand firm against the schemes, stand firm against the lies of Satan, to stand firm when Satan tries to destroy us. Peter goes on and says, "And the God of all grace, who called you to His eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while." And this is how God is going to work in our lives the rest of verse 10. Number one, He will restore us. After having suffered a little while, He will restore you. And again, this is a more literal translation because especially as we get further, some of these words have a little bit different meaning than what the NIV uses. But He will restore you. The understanding is He will make us complete. He will make us fully qualified. In other words, God is going to work in our lives in such a way that He is going to allow us to become mature and allow us to be complete as a follower of Him. Number two, He will restore you. He will establish you. He will make us committed, this inwardly firm. In other words, and this is this understanding of that we will be able to hang on to our faith and our trust in Jesus Christ. No matter what life throws at us, we will be able to stand firm because we will have solid roots that go down deep into the ground. We were, one of the things we have learned moving to Bedford is that the wind here is nuts, especially at the church. There have been times in our house where we hear the wind, and we were walking up, took a walk in the trails above our house yesterday, and just walking up in the woods there and just seeing the trees knocked over is unbelievable. Now, there's those woods, people, they've probably been down for years or so forth, but just the amount of windblown trees. And you see that so many times. We had a pine tree out in front of our house, and every time the wind blew, this thing was just going like bonkers to the point where we were like, we got to cut this tree down or it's going to fall on our house. But if you ever walked and you saw like a tree that's topped over and you have this giant like root ball just above the ground, the reason why that tree didn't survive that windstorm is because it had shallow roots. And when the wind came and blew it, the ground gave way and it toppled. Whereas usually those are pine trees. Not all the case, but usually oak trees are the ones that have the deep roots that go way down deep into the ground. If you've seen an oak tree, and we have some of these in our property where these oak trees and they're just waving and going bonkers in the wind, and they're creaking and cracking and things, and you're thinking, man, is this thing going to survive? And there's some on our property that have probably been there for 50 plus years. And the only reason why they survive is because they have that solid root system. That's what this understanding is, that God will establish you. He will make you be able to hang on and not let go. Third one, He will restore you. He will establish you. He will strengthen you. He will make us strong. Again, this is how God is going to work in our lives. This is not something of, oh my goodness, I got to try like X, Y, Z to become like this. This is how God is going to work. He makes us complete. He establishes us. He makes us committed to be able to hang on. He makes us strong to have that faith, that trust that we're able to survive. And then this last one is even more so. He will cause you to have a secure base. And again, the NIV translates it a little bit different, where if you look at the NIV, it says this at the end of verse 10. You have suffered a little while, will himself restore you, will make you strong, firm, and steadfast. The understanding of steadfast means that he will give you a strong foundation, a secure foundation. He will cause us to have a secure foundation. Again, we get this strong, solid faith, though this foundation of our lives is as God works in our lives. It is not, oh my goodness, I have to have this 10-step plan to become a mature follower of Jesus Christ. It is as God works in our lives, this is what's going to happen. He is going to allow us to be able to stand firm, to not give up, to continue to walk and continue to trust in him regardless of what's happening. When people come after us, and again, in the context, in the historical context of 1 Peter's writing this, and Peter's writing this, as people come after you and as you suffer persecution, don't freak out because God is at work and he will allow you to continue to stand firm and not give up. As believers in Jesus Christ nowadays, when you get that phone call, the worst news that you can imagine in your life, don't give up because God's at work. And he will allow you to continue to trust in him regardless of the situation. We get this strong, solid faith as God works in our lives. And what's our rule? Again, the context, verse 6, humble yourselves. As we humble ourselves before God, who is our King. Yes, God is sovereign. He is King of Kings. He is Lord of Lords. He is sovereign over everything in this world. But when you come to know Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you recognize, God, you are my King. You are my Master. You are my Lord. And I humble myself. Would you work in my life according to your plan? As we humble ourselves before God, who is our King, we then desire to do His will in our lives. And as we desire to do God's will in our lives, as we humble ourselves before God, who is our King, he says, Peter says here, then God will work in our lives, giving us the strength, giving us the courage, giving us the ability to stand firm in the gospel of Jesus Christ. No matter what life throws at us, we will be able to hang on. We will be able to trust in Him above everything else. We will be able, the desire to be able to walk in obedience to Him. There are so many people nowadays, especially when it comes to the Christian music industry, there are so many people who are going and saying, no, I don't believe in Jesus anymore. I'm walking away. And you always have to ask that question, well, what happened? And usually when you hear their story and you hear their testimony of how did they get to the place where they decided they don't believe in Jesus anymore and they want to walk away from the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's usually because of something happening in their life, usually because they were praying about something and God didn't answer the way they thought that God should have answered, or something tragic has happened. Or they get the phone call saying, hey, you have cancer. And as you go through that time, they struggle and they're wrestling. And it's usually because they do not have strong roots in their relationship with Jesus Christ. Because what happens so many times, especially with American Christianity, is we think in ourselves that God is here to serve us, not we are here to serve God. And it begins with what Peter says here in verse 6. We are to humble ourselves. And as we humble ourselves, God says, I'm going to work in your life. And I'm going to allow you to stand against Satan and against the schemes of your enemy. I'm going to work in your life in such a way that no matter what life throws at you, you are going to have those strong roots, that you're going to have that solid faith, that you're going to be able to stand firm. When people come after you and make fun of you being a follower of Jesus Christ, you're going to be able to stand firm. If they come after you and throw you in prison, you're going to be able to stand firm. And that's exactly what you see all around the world. In places where it's illegal to be a follower of Jesus Christ, where they throw them in prison, they come out more solid in their faith and their trust in God than when they went in. As followers of Jesus Christ, we need to humble ourselves before our King, and we need to allow our King to work in our lives in such a way that He makes us more like Himself, that we have that solid foundation, that we are able to stand firm. Do you realize tonight the kids and the youth tonight are going to talk about, you know, what is worship? And sometimes we throw that term around of praise and worship, we're going to church to worship God. And usually that's what we think, that worship is just four or five songs that we sing in church and that's it. One of the words that is translated worship in the Old Testament actually means this, to bow down. Because what we're doing, and it's just not through music, our entire lives, what we say, what we do, everything, we need to have this attitude of we are bowing down before our King and saying, Lord Jesus, you're my King. I'm your servant. I'm here to serve you. I'm here to walk in obedience to you. I'm here to bow down. I'm your servant.